Interrupting the current neo-Ukrainian climate challenge, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting episode BTWRLM 660. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed. And we're coming on to donation month. Want to get everybody primed for that. We don't do this too much. We've been asking a little bit more for donations this whole year. There's been a lot of work, a lot of investment going on, and I missed the last broadcast because a piece of equipment went out, and I couldn't get it fixed right before the broadcast, and that caused the problem. So we try to do backups, but we haven't been able to do that yet. So get ready to give your coffees if you can, and help Sound pull this thing together. There's been a whole lot more to all pull this together as we start to see how this whole internet thing, this what I call the Siberian gulag, has been pulled together and making it so, and even being a spectator may be taken from you if and you don't cough up your participation privilege, unless more judges start doing as this federal judge did to strike down Louisiana's social media digital ID age verification law as unconstitutional. And so those of you that are interested in helping yourselves and helping the rest, who may not, and there's not many, I can just tell you, there's not many that will step up. And it is only a few that can do this and pull it off. And you come in with the law and the facts, and you let them know. And listen to this case on how this judge is going. Again, this is a district court. And it seems over the last 10 years, the district courts don't have much power because they really have been not so good. And I think the judicial branch is showing what it really is. And that's a very big problem. But it doesn't mean that we can't use what still exists in order to bring things along and make it better as we can, as we believe we can, even though most of society is not trained to do so, and the specialist in society took control and to take over our lives in the future that they want. And again, I go over this and don't see many people talking about these subject matters the way I do and where I come from to do that. And we all look at this thing that's going down as if we have no part in it. There's going to be a part in for everybody. Comply or die is not a thing you want to be dealing with. And there is ways. I've seen every place I look, there's always a small out if you had looked close enough. In this case, we do have a judge at least starting to push back. My point here is listen for the whys of it. Look and see if that went far enough. As I've told you before, the great Kobe swindle, none of the attorneys came in with the right premise, and they were shut down pretty quickly. There shouldn't have been a question. There should not have been an issue before the court. It should have been self-evident. And so that's what the attorneys do. In this case, the judge looks at this as Louisiana's attempt to make a social media companies verify the ages of their users with a digital ID has been struck down, with a federal judge ruling that the law violates the First Amendment and imposes unconstitutional burdens on lawful speech. So don't stop there. There's going to be reasons for this. You want to analyze the correctness of it, and I think on this set of tabs, there's going to be a place where the judges didn't, and they came up with something, and it's not right. It's a misinterpretation of their own discussion, and so you have to parse through all this, because these systems want us to go to the future that they want. Who's the they? It's whomever's going to be in control of the occupying forces that are running everyone's lives into the ground. Austerity still sits there. You're watching your lives be turned into that. And part of it was our fault as people not sticking to honest money. Seriously. There was a reason why we should have stuck to it, whether or not the government wanted to see it. Whether or not the government and its licensees would continue down that path. In his 94-page decision, U.S. District Judge John DeGravels of Louisiana's Middle District found that the Secure Online Child Interaction and Age Limitation Act, quote, is at once under-inclusive and over-inclusive, close quote. The court stated, quote, it is under-inclusive in that minors can encounter the same potential harmful content on unregulated websites and can gain more or less unrestricted access to covered platforms upon satisfying the one-time age verification and parental consent requirements. So add that into this, as I've been saying to you, they've been taking away your majority, and now all of a sudden we see there's a parental permission that has to be had. Well, if your parental permission doesn't have to be had, then what is this standard about for you, is one of the major requirements. But this over-inclusiveness is that it burdens a large amount of protected speech for minors and adults alike. And it is seemingly largely redundant of existing parental controls. And this becomes a standard in law, least intrusive. So keep track of these things. And I'd say all these things to try and point them out. A lot of people don't even talk about them. It's how you go and analyze what you're being faced with when you're faced with authority, for sure. But in particular, if the government believes or it looks like it's presumed even to have the authority, you have to be able to respond to these things. For those of you that know jurisdictional challenges, this may be where part of that is as well. Why I bring all these things up is they start locking us down more and more and more, and people generally don't respond. No, they do the really dumb things. Oh, we're going to have a tax protest now. Don't know the first thing about what they're doing. Still use the fiat. Still came in underneath a master-slave relationship in their jobs. Still have the government taking all their stuff. But they're going to go have a tax protest. Yeah, that'll work. It's not like I'm regressing to the 90s now, where I started to come in and notice there was problems. Good people being beat down by the government. I wondered how. We're supposed to have rights. How are they doing that? How are they abusing people this way? And this has been that long a time of study. Whether or not I have all the answers is irrelevant. There's a different way to look at things, and most people don't have that different way. And I found out to get you behind the woodshed, you start learning that way, and you bring everybody who's an authority back behind the woodshed, and you take care of that. And there's a way to do that as well. The case, Net Choice versus Merle, was brought by an industry group representing Meta, X, Snapchat, and YouTube. What I find interesting here is I don't hear people in this case, and that's a problem. NetChoice argued that the law forced both minors and adults to submit identifying information before they could speak or read online, an approach it said would chill speech and invade privacy. What about your right to gather evidence, gather information? What about all that? That's all pertinent rights to these express rights. None of that is mentioned here. It's only referenced but not stated specifically. Judge De Gravelis agreed, writing that, quote, most of the Act's restrictions are all or nothing proposals, close quote. He explained, quote, an adult or minor must verify her age, at which point she will gain access to more or less the entire platform. But if she balks at the age verification process, then she will be barred from the platform, including its many forms of fully protected speech, close quote. Drawing on Supreme Court precedents, the judge reaffirmed that, quote, even minors are entitled to significant measure of First Amendment protections, and that states do not have, quote, a free-floating power to restrict the ideas to which children may be exposed, close quote. There's your acquisition right. He added that, quote, to foreclose access to social media altogether is to prevent the user from engaging in legitimate exercise of First Amendment rights. And I read this stuff and I'm thinking, that we have them printed down is important because apparently when you look at this, people in power will take this stuff from you. And that just shocks me to my core. You have to have it in writing so someone won't abuse you. Is a fascination to me as we look at peace on earth and goodwill toward men. No, it does not exist, apparently, unless it's written down, and even that's going to be attacked. This judge comes to point some things out for us, though, if we didn't have another thought. The court also warned of a broader risk that arises when governments justify speech restrictions as a safety measures. Quote, the protections. And let me highlight this word protections, because I don't think courts and judges do this enough in the first instance. To be secure, like in the Fourth Amendment, to be secure, to be, is ahead of the point, not after the fact. I don't think I've ever seen too many court cases ever that enforce to be. It's not to be, it's to be. Where government is looking to keep the people protected and what they say secure. The protections of the First Amendment are triggered not only by actual restrictions, De Gravelis wrote, but, quote, the risk of a chilling effect is enough because First Amendment freedoms need breathing space to survive, close quote. Louisiana Attorney General Liz Merle, who defended the law, said the decision was, quote, very disappointing, and pledged to appeal. She maintained that the policy simply aimed to reinforce parental authority online. If that's all it was supposed to do, that's all it was supposed to do, but it doesn't. Why the lawsuit? Paul Fiske, co-director of NetChoices Litigation Center, said the ruling protects both speech and privacy. Quote, Louisiana's law would have done more than chill free speech, he said. It would have created a massive privacy risk for Louisianans, like those playing out in real time in the countries without First Amendment, like the UK. Judge DeGravelis ordered the state to pay NetChoices attorney fees and court costs. In his words, quote, when the government restricts speech, the government bears the burden of proving the constitutionality of its actions. Close quote. Absolutely. I don't think we see this standard put in place very much. The court concluded that Louisiana had failed to meet that burden. And so I would say, read this story, go through it, see what they're saying. There's a whole lot more in there. I don't know what the case filings were about, but there could have been a whole lot more talking, but you're seeing the real basic things being touched. And the acquisition is very important right there. I thought this was very cool. They don't talk about it like that, but they mention it in passing, if you will, that the access of even a child is, under the First Amendment, is to be protected. You cannot put an obstruction before that happens. In the ongoing saga of the Trump administration's propensity to deny people due process, just because anything goes, whatever it takes, right? We're in an abject, piratical land of lawlessness, or a land of the lost, but maybe we ain't, not quite yet. And if you find you're not actually a spectator when the next pirate tries to commandeer, nicked-eared and all, your vessel, judge says Abrego Garcia can remain free for now. She says she's growing beyond impatient with the government's misrepresentations. Again, this is Newstis. Take notice of this news to us, that the government will not stay within the bounds. It will always break those bounds and have to be caught. And I don't think people appreciate this condition. And when we have that's why I keep focusing on the appearance of impropriety. We are so far from that standard. There's nobody in government that's afraid to breach that standard, and that's the standard. You can't even really think about breaching it, and you could be found in liability as an official. I don't think I've ever seen that actually imposed. We've heard it talked about a little bit, but not to the standard like it's supposed to be, like the Fourth Amendment to be secure. No, they do it after the fact, and they take most of that away. By all these whatever things they want to make up. The judges are not sitting in the trusteeship of the people in their protection that they were supposed to do. Where do I get that? Comes right out of the Virginia Constitution that I read. So clearly is that the first 5-6 sections written. You see how the government's to lay it out, and you see the judges are like number 2 in the list of how important they are to protect right after the very first section. It's fascinating what we should be seeing or not. Because we don't really insist anymore. We'll grumble, but we won't actually step up and do or get together to do things that we really need to do. And I don't mean making all these wild accusations. Find real simple stuff to go after. Like in this case, a federal judge on Monday questioned whether government officials could be trusted to follow orders barring them from taking Kilmar Abrego Garcia into immigration custody or deporting him. Now, what am I talking about? A lot of people will say, oh, this guy just should be deported. He's illegal, he's a criminal, all this, whatever. I just entered this discussion on due process rights. And you're seeing, many people that get involved with the government and the judicial branch will realize, you're watching the government will misrepresent their cause. It's like, that's the only thing they're supposed to do, notwithstanding they're supposed to do justice. Like that, what is it? Oh, it's just us. Oh, we forgot. So I'm reading these things to show you, this is not about Kilmar Abrego Garcia and immigration. This is about, we're seeing facts being stated and notices to us, the government will misrepresent its position and its prosecutions and its evidence and everything else. U.S. District Judge Paula Zenas noted that Abrego Garcia was already deported without legal authority once and said that she was, quote, growing beyond impatient, close quote, with the government's misrepresentations in her court. Quote, why should I give the respondents the benefit of the doubt, close quote, she asked, referring to the government's attorneys. Zenas ordered Abrego Garcia released from immigration custody on December 11th after determining that the government had no viable plan for deporting him. She followed that with a temporary restraining order the next day, barring Immigration and Customs Enforcement from immediately taking him back into custody. The Monday hearing was to determine if the temporary restraining order should be dissolved. The hearing was a glimpse into the complexity of immigration proceedings as Zenas tried to get information on the status of Abrego Garcia's case. Quote, I am trying to get to the bottom of whether there are going to be any removal proceedings, close quote, she said as she questioned the government's lawyer. Quote, you haven't told me what you're going to do next, close quote. Zenas said she would leave the restraining order in place for now while she considers the issue, close quote. Quote, this is an extremely irregular and extraordinary situation, close quote, Zenas told attorneys. Abrego Garcia, his wife, and his legal team were welcomed to the federal court building in Maryland by a boisterous reception that included a choir, bullhorn, and a drum as scores of supporters cheered. Inside the courtroom, Abrego Garcia sat with at least half a dozen defense team members while a lone government attorney sat across from them. Before his release, Abrego Garcia had been in immigration detention since August. In that time, government had said it planned to deport him to Uganda, Eswatini, Ghana, and most certainly Liberia. However, officials had made no effort to deport him to the one country he had agreed to go to, Costa Rica. Zenas has even accused the government of misleading her by falsely claiming that Costa Rica was unwilling to take him. And let me offer just a reminder of the court cases that have been gone to where we start hearing judges were finally having to call out the attorneys for misleading them. I've read the reports on this. It doesn't seem to go anywhere, and these attorneys just seem to continue to have their jobs. And this has to be fought, and it's not easy. And I'm not ever said it's easy. But when you get yourself tangled up with this, I'm saying read this, and you start to understand better what the problems are. Everyone who wants to turn their head, you might escape, but when you don't, what are you going to do? How are you going to challenge this? Are you going to make it as tough on them as they're trying to make it on you? And that's a very hard thing to do, but you can do it. The government's, quote, persistent refusal to acknowledge Costa Rica as a viable removal option, their threats to send Abrego Garcia to African countries that never agreed to take him, and their misrepresentations to the court that Liberia is now the only country available to Abrego Garcia, all reflect that whatever purpose was behind his detention, it was not for the basic purpose of timely third country removal, she wrote. In court on Monday, Abrego Garcia's attorneys reiterated that he is prepared to go to Costa Rica today. Abrego Garcia has an American wife and a child and has lived in Maryland for years, but he immigrated to the U.S. illegally from El Salvador as a teenager. In 2019, an immigration judge granted him protections from being deported back to his home country because he faced danger there from a gang that had targeted his family. Although he is back in the U.S. now, the Department of Homeland Security officials have said he cannot stay and have vowed to deport him to a third country. Now, I guess to interject here, remember, U.S. citizens have been picked up by this system. Regular U.S. citizens have been picked up. And I think, remember, one was sent out? Is the importance of all this. In addition to a Maryland case, Abrego Garcia is fighting human smuggling charges in Tennessee. His attorneys in that case on Friday asked the judge for sanctions against Border Patrol's Gregory Bovino, made disparaging comments about their client on national news. The judge previously ordered Justice Department and Homeland Security officials to cease making comments that could prejudice Abrego Garcia's right to a fair trial. Now, isn't it amazing how much due process Trump wants to destroy in people? How he wants to breach the separation of powers? How misrepresentations to the court by his minions is acceptable? Because whatever it takes. Except adhering to the law, of course. And on that note, whatever happened with the to-be-secured part of the 14th Amendment, as the government grabs all the Constitution's protections, from an article reporting on a recent privacy-affecting decisions written by Kevin Okemwa. And remember, I've been saying third-party liability is going to get people. This Commonwealth versus Kurtz just gave everyone the right to not choose to have a phone, in particular where government insists, or to take every measure to avoid such third-party vulnerabilities, taking the Fifth Amendment to do so. Google's fine print may cost your Fourth Amendment rights. Pennsylvania Supreme Court allows authorities to access your search history without a warrant. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania recently ruled police can access Google searches without a warrant. The privacy and security are among the most sought-after elements when users are selecting a browser for their day-to-day activities, especially as companies like Perplexity make their debut in the landscape with AI-powered browsers like Comet. For the longest time, your browser history remained exclusive to you, save for speculations that companies like Google and Facebook are tracking your digital footprint and using your search history to serve ads. For context, the police have been trying to establish who committed a sexual assault of a person with the initials KM. The authorities submitted that the person behind the heinous crime might have searched Google for KM's name or address before committing the crime. As such, the court ruled that the authorities were within their rights to access a potential offender's search history without a warrant. The court argued that everyone using these services knows they are being watched anyway. I'll reread that. The court argued that everyone using these services knows that they are being watched anyway. According to the court, quote, it is a common knowledge that websites, internet-based applications, and internet service providers collect and then sell user data. Consequently, the authorities obtained a, quote, reverse keyword search warrant, close quote, which allowed them to ask Google to hand over the IP address of any user who Googled the name of an or address of the victim leading up to the commission of the crime. The software giant complied and released the information, highlighting the exact IP address that had been used to conduct two searches for KM's address just a few hours before the attack. Interestingly, the IP address was traced back to the residence of the defendant. The authorities didn't suspect Kurtz of the crime, but they had started to watch him closely and even obtained a DNA sample that was traced back to the crime scene. While the loophole buried in legal fine print might have been used to bring a criminal to book and conclude the case, it still raises critical privacy concerns. But the justices argued, and I thought it was that the attorneys argue and the judges independently apply law to facts. But the justices argued that the Google's privacy policy sort of constitutes a consent form. In the case before us, Google went beyond subtle indicators. Google expressly informed its users that one should not expect any privacy when using its services. This formed the foundation and the basis of the court's argument that users had already signed away their Fourth Amendment rights by agreeing to comply with Google's privacy policies. What's more, the court argued some more that users could avoid creating data trails by choosing not to interact with the internet entirely. Quote, the data trail created by using the internet is not involuntary in the same way that the trail created by carrying a cell phone is, close quote, the justices concluded. It's not? The phone goes through the same third-party service providers that the court admits, quote, it is common knowledge that websites, internet-based applications, and internet service providers collect and sell user data. T-Mobile, for instance, was recently fined $92 million for T-Mobile selling location data without consent, but this decision sets a precedent making it legal to give the government that information now. How is that not the same trail, by the same third parties that cannot be escaped if the device is to remain a phone. Now, I'm not sure how people will de-service provider and still have a phone like they can de-Google. Or is this the proof by court decision, as I've been instructing for years, the phone is the key to the voluntary digital panopticon, Siberian gulag token citizenship, where there is no property, therefore no rights, and you will like it. And that occurred long before Klaus Genghis Khan Schwabi said it. By that logic, you voluntarily gave up all your rights for exercising your rights of locomotion to ingress and egress your property. So is this next story a potential future global model creeping into our gates? Remember, the cameras that flock you everywhere you go are not illegal, but the data and images grabbed up are public, subject to government information requests and disclosure. As we read, inside Uzbekistan's nationwide license plate surveillance system. Across Uzbekistan, a network of about 100 banks of high-resolution roadside cameras continuously scan vehicles' license plates and their occupants, sometimes thousands a day, looking for potential traffic violations. Cars running red lights, drivers not wearing their seatbelts, and unlicensed vehicles driving at night, to name a few. The driver of one of these surveilled vehicles in the system was tracked over 6 months, and he traveled between eastern city of Cherchik through the capital Tashkent and in the nearby settlement of Eshganguzar, often multiple times a week. We know this because the country's sprawling license plate tracking surveillance system has been left exposed to the internet. Security researcher Anurang Sen, who discovered the security lapse, found that the license plate surveillance system exposed online without a password, allowing anyone access to the data within. It's not clear how long the surveillance system has been public, but artifacts from the system show that its database was set up in September of 2024 and traffic monitoring began mid-2025. The exposure offers a rare glimpse into how national license plate surveillance systems work, the data they collect, and how they can be used to track the whereabouts of any one of the millions of people across an entire country. The lapse also reveals the security and privacy risk associated with mass monitoring of vehicles, their owners, at the time when the United States is building up its nationwide array of license plate readers, many of which are provided by surveillance giant Flock. These are not strangers to this broadcast. The exposure of Uzbekistan's national license plate reading system is the latest example of a security lapse involving road surveillance cameras. I need to interject on this. They're focusing on the lapse that allows the government to continue it even if they lock it down. The point is, they can track you down. If you read here, listen what the government misrepresents and how they make stuff up. This should concern everybody. As I've said before, it's a carnival mirror we're looking at internationally. They may have it real well set up back in Uzbekistan. They're doing it different, but they're doing it here in the United States of America, public and private, fascist-like. Earlier this year, Wired reported that more than 150 license plate readers around the United States on the real-time vehicle data they grabbed were exposed to the internet without any security. And to me, that's part of not the problem. The problem is they're doing it, and there's a people behind that that make stuff up, misrepresent. They're part of the government. They get money to misrepresent. They feel good that they're able to continue their work. It's like an arson you find out was a firefighter. Only your life is now torched. And because, apparently, grabbing is in fashion, U.S. seizure of Venezuelan oil mirrors global trend. President Donald Trump has announced that the U.S. will keep or sell oil confiscated from Venezuela. What precedent does this set? Quote, thus far in 2025, governments are experiencing the Trump-Vance administration's announcing, crafting, and implementing decision perceived by the White House as within the confines of international law, close quote, John Kavulich, an American political scientist and expert in international politics, tells Sputnik. Because they perceive international law allows theft of the property of another, because they've also fabricated that belief, that they can unilaterally determine the other has no property and will like it. Sound familiar, Klaus, Genghis Khan, Schwab? Without property or rights, there is nothing they're stealing either. In other words, Trump and Vance are making Somali piracy great again, not America. And while the administration attacks Somalia in favor of Somaliland that Israel is now supporting, because the United States government does not like competition. The U.S. Justice Department and other federal agencies routinely endorses and condone what the White House does, according to the pundit. Hence, it's hardly surprising that Washington gets away with the seizure of Venezuelan oil. Quote, there are legions of attorneys who will create opinions justifying the goals and objectives of the government, close quote. The oil is for Trump like an extra Big Mac and Diet Cola. He will not turn it down, Kovalich notes. And I thought it was thou shalt not be gluttonous. I guess not for Pope Trump. And the Bible equating gluttons to drunkards, wasn't it reported by Susie Wiles, White House Chief of Staff, that Trump has an alcoholic's personality, notwithstanding her complaint that the Vanity Fair mischaracterized her interview, and with Trump agreeing with her that he has an alcoholic's personality. He doesn't have to be an alcoholic. The personality type equates to gluttony, linked to idolatry. The inability of moderation and self-control, evidencing ingratitude and want of proper dominion, the proper managing of God's gifts, in what the peace taker in chief unilaterally determines would please Emperor Trump himself, irrespective of anyone, thing, or obligation, or duty. Quote, President Trump is using the victor goes to spoils and righting past wrongs to defend the confiscation of oil and thus far oil tankers. It's victor spoils doesn't sound too peacemaker-like to me. How does it sound to you? And unilaterally righting past wrongs? What, like the riotous BLM or reparations movements trying to right the past wrongs unilaterally because they say so, as BLM organizers scam the system, only woke right style? What's worse, this approach is increasingly trending elsewhere, according to the expert. Indeed, the EU leadership has repeatedly tried to find a loophole in the bloc's regulations to seize frozen Russian sovereign assets, most of which are held by Belgium's Euroclear, which robbery attempt for the much-hyped reparations loan to Ukraine appears to have gone belly up because the criminal Euro cartel doesn't think it can survive the shootout when Russia comes to get its stuff back. Another clue and lesson. Facing strong resistance from Belgium, EU mafia wannabe leaders have dropped the plan for now. In March, German seized Eviton, an oil tanker flying the Panamanian flag that originally departed from the Russian port of Ust-Luga and sought to confiscate nearly 100,000 tons of oil. However, on December 11th, Germany's top fiscal court ruled that the German authorities cannot sell or otherwise use the tanker and its cargo. If thou shalt not steal is ultimately a thing, yeah, without God's mercy, it appears Trump won't be going to heaven, and he said he knows that. Actually, he didn't acknowledge God's ultimate dominion, just that he didn't think he'd be getting to heaven, and Trump's spoils to the victor intention shouldn't make people too comfortable at home, because your stuff is likely next, or if you haven't heard, the unaccountable asset forfeiture government theft under color of authority, as President Trump did endorsing civil asset forfeiture, piracy on the land, what's known as booty, seizures, which let the standing army among us in this occupied territory, euphemistically called police, seize even innocent people's property, in 2017 already. So if you think the Trump or this country is still a thou shalt not steal God-fearing country, I suggest you look again and rethunk your presumption-managed thinker. From the Department of Doing You a Favor side-dealing, Section 595, what does Venezuela-related General License 5T authorize? President issued Executive Order EO-13835 on May 21st, 2018. If for all Trump's bluster, you don't think all this stuff has a history and he knows about it. Subsection 1A triple I of EU 13835 prohibits U.S. persons from engaging in transactions related to the sale, transfer, assignment, or pledging as collateral by the government of Venezuela of any equity interest in an entity owned 50% or more by the Gov. General License 5 was replaced and superseded by General License 5A on October 24, 2019, with a delay in the effectiveness of the authorization of the general license. Since that date, OFAC has extended the delay in effectiveness multiple times. Most recently, OFAC issued General License 5T on December 19, 2025, which further delays the effectiveness of the authorization of GL5 until February 3, 2026. Now, why would Trump let Citigo continue to profit from United States oil he says is ours as the United States with this order in place? The order freezes the judicial auction in Delaware initiated by the Biden administration in 2022 and 2023, despite there being a preliminary winner with a $5.9 billion Bravo dollar offer from the refiner's parent company. This is the same company that gave Americans heating oil years and years ago, back in Hugo Chavez's time, as I reported a couple episodes ago. The extensions mean that Venezuela's Citgo continues to operate profitably in the U.S., allowing for negotiations between creditors and representatives of Venezuela to avoid forced liquidation of the company. To the extent an agreement may be reached on proposals to restructure or refinance payments due to the holders of the PDVSA 2020 8.5% bond, additional licensing requirements may apply. OFAC would encourage parties to apply for specific licenses and would have a favorable licensing policy toward such an agreement. So what's all the bluster and bravado going on about Venezuelan oil? And then we just heard that, again, Maduro came out and said, we'll deal with the United States. The United States wants our oil. We'll make a fair deal with them, like we already are doing with Chevron. And speaking of scamming or taking advantage of the people, only woke right style, Zhao Chengpeng confirmed the Trump family has launched a USD1 stablecoin with a total supply of 3.5 million, Mike, on the Binance chain. FX168 Financial News. News on-chain monitoring platform LookOnChain found that World Liberty Financial, a decentralized finance or DeFi project owned by the United States President Trump's family, has deployed its USD1 stablecoin on Binance Chain. On-chain information shows that the current total supply of this token is around 3.5 million and there are only 6 token holders. Cointelegraph reports that Trump's WLFI has launched a stablecoin pegged to the U.S. dollar with a total supply of more than $3.5 million. And at the time I told you what they were doing, and Trump was in on it, right? He allowed this law, and his family was ready to go, as were others in the know. According to Etherscan and BSCScan data, the project party launched the World Liberty Financial USD1 stablecoin in early March. World Liberty, folks, not American first, not America greatest. Binance founder Chengpeng Zhao said in a tweet that WLFI's USD1 stablecoin smart contract was deployed 20 days ago. He wrote, quote, "Welcome WLFI to Binance Chain." According to BSC Scan, the smart contract was deployed and built 20 days ago, close quote. He then followed up with a post reminding investors, quote, "Since the article was published, I've heard that many scammers have created tokens under the same name. The official USD1 can't be traded yet, so don't be fooled." The WLF1 project emphasized that the USD1 stablecoin cannot be traded at this time, close quote. For all you Trumpsters and Pomeranians who want that, can't be traded. 6 people already owed it. How do you like that? Look on Chain wrote, quote, "Trump's WLFI project is already on Binance Chain, and Wintermute's public wallet appears to have made some test transfers using USD1. Quote, Wu talks about blockchain, close quote, in the Chinese currency industry, also followed up on the news and indicated the stablecoin suspected to be launched by the Trump Family Fund on the Binance chain in World Liberty Financial USD, USD1. On-chain information shows that the current holding is at 3.5 million with only six holders. Repeated stories looking and studying and all coming to the same observation. And if and you can't trust Google with your digital security because you consented when using its service allowing third-party collection of your data, what's a token citizen gonna do? World's largest aviation giant abandons Google over security concerns. And I've got to interject, I found this story quite a few weeks ago and just getting to it. And boy, didn't it fold into this series of tabs this week much better. Airbus has cited U.S. jurisdiction risks as it prepares to move sensitive systems to European sovereign cloud. European aerospace corporation Airbus has decided to move critical digital systems away from Google's cloud services. Company executives say that the decision is driven by security and data sovereignty concerns linked to the U.S. jurisdiction over sensitive industrial information. And I just anticipate something for you if you haven't picked it up. I want you to consider your sovereignty, your data, your life to be needing the security that this company is saying that they can't find in Google, or now we know, even the phone system. A decision comes as Google faces a class action lawsuit in the United States over alleged privacy violations linked to its AI assistant Gemini. Don't you think the last case just proved that to be incorrect? It's not an allegation of privacy concerns. The lawsuit claims that the tool was quietly activated across Gmail, Chat, and Meet in October, giving Google access to emails, attachments, and video calls without user consent. Google has denied the allegations. Airbus is now preparing to tender a major contract to migrate mission-critical workloads to a digitally sovereign European cloud. Can I offer for you, what about your life-critical workloads and remove them from a digital sovereign cloud? Please, consider that seriously. The company, which currently uses Google Workspace, plans to move key on-premises systems after consolidating its data center estate. Think about that word tied together, your data center estate. The shift would cover core systems. Listen to all the words now coming out from the AI systems things of core. The shift would cover their core systems, including production, business management, and aircraft design data. How about designing your own life in your own cloud? Not really in the cloud. Quote, I need a sovereign cloud because part of the information is extremely sensitive from a national and European perspective, close quote, Airbus Executive Vice President of Digital, Catherine Justin, told the Register. Quote, we want to ensure this information remains under European control. I thought that was an interesting segue. Why don't they want to have control of it? Why do they let a government? There is no European, actually. There's an EU, but there's no European. Europe is a bunch of different countries. So they're commingling a bunch of weird concepts here. However, they're even giving up their own information to a European control structure. I'm asking my listener, don't do that. No foreign control structure. And I'm not talking Europe. I'm talking your United States government, your state governments, your county governments. Airbus, which has led the global aircraft order race for the past 6 years, acknowledged earlier this month that U.S. rival Boeing is likely to overtake it this year. CEO Guillaume Faury said Boeing benefited from a political backing during the trade negotiations that included major aircraft purchases. United States President Donald Trump has publicly claimed credit for boosting Boeing sales, saying earlier this month that he received an award from the manufacturer for being, quote, the greatest salesman in the history of Boeing. Ah, the greatest salesman, not the greatest president. The greatest salesman for selling people a pig and a poke. Right, Gen Z? But while Airbus is moving its information to Europe because of higher integrity, is beyond me, where a court forces callous to publicly retract false claims. This is a sort of like trust the science only political, right? The top EU diplomat has admitted to posting lies about the Estonian politician in 2022. EU foreign policy chief Kaja Kallas has been forced by a court to publicly retract false claims she made about an Estonian opposition politician. In a social media post on February 17, 2022, Kallas, Estonia's prime minister at the time, claimed that police were attacked at a protest organized by Vero Vuglaid, an MP from the Conservative People's Party of Estonia and the Foundation for the Protection of Family and Tradition, which he heads. She also linked Vuglaid to a 2021 COVID-19 restrictions rally in Tallinn. Vuglaid and SAPTK sued Kallas in 2022, saying her claims had no factual basis. So this kind of gets over to what I was saying earlier in the broadcast already. You have to start to get involved. I'm not really thrilled about going to the courts, but when you have a simple statement to make, and I've told you this before, like habeas corpus and or you do injunctions, you might be able to get a lot of headway to do it like this, notwithstanding the corruption that's in the courts. And part of that is an analysis as well. So someone gets in, maybe they got their attorneys and they were able to prevail here to get someone to, an official, to retract false claims, which for them stands as the law and right until it is thrown down. And this is how this thing progresses in history. Nation to nation, politician from politician, whatever, bureaucrat, bureaucrat, or whomever. Last year, the Estonian court ruled in their favor, finding no police were attacked at rallies organized by Vuglaid and the SAPTK, and that neither was linked to the Tallinn demonstration. Earlier this week, Estonian Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal to the case, making the ruling final. Kallas posted her retraction on Facebook on Saturday. I find this fascinating. These platforms, third-party platforms that can steal your rights, are where officials go to give their official discussions and legal judgments error. How do you like that? Disqualified. Talk about a publication of public record. They're supposed to be printed, and they're supposed to be in locales, like your counties in the United States. This is global now. Don't underestimate the power of what we're watching already happening in the world. We go to Facebook in order to give a public notice. You better be on Facebook then, huh? I, Kaja Kallas, published false factual claims in the post of February 17, 2022, stating that Estonia police were attacked at a demonstration organized by Vero Vuglaid and SAPTK in Kumpia, and that Vero Vuglaid and EKRE organized a demonstration on October 23, 2021 at Freedom Square in Tallinn. These claims are untrue. She did not apologize to either plaintiff. Kallas has faced repeated criticism over the accuracy of her public statements. She recently claimed that Russia invaded at least 19 countries over the past 100 years, quote, none of which ever invaded or attacked Russia, a claim that lacks any factual basis. The remark, later echoed by Finnish Foreign Minister Elina Valtonen, led Russian Foreign Minister spokeswoman Maria Zakharova to accuse Western Europe of, quote, deliberately promoting the inept and uneducated, close quote, to top government posts. So, this caucusocracy, folks, right there. Somebody else witnessing the fact that you hear behind the woodshed in our own country. It's just not different, is it? Separately, Kallas expressed surprise to learn that the Russian and China defeated fascism in World War II, calling it, quote, something new, close quote. The comment prompted Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to suggest she should study history and in which she, quote, clearly does not excel, close quote. And I'll say, and apparently not much of anything but stupid warmongery. That's S-T-O-O-P-I-D, warmongery, for the hearing sensitive. Europe is truly run by the caucusocracy, the worst, rising to the top. In this case, likely the liverwurst, rising to the top to rule everybody. Not democracy one little bit, even in the best connotation of that weapon. And warmongery it is. I thought women were more loving and caring. That's what I was told as being brought up and looked forward to the day that women would rule in certain places. No, I guess not. The caucusocracy elite psychopathy appears to be gender neutral. Tallis has also faced growing criticism for her hardline approach to foreign policy and hawkish stance on Russia. Analysts and EU officials have accused her of favoring confrontation over diplomacy. The Czech newspaper HN reported this month that her work style is increasingly seen as, quote, unproductive. And yet, she hasn't been run out on a rail, tarred and feathered. And that's how it rolls. That's how she rolls. That's how it's going to work until she gets taken out. You don't have to be vicious about it. Just get her out the way. And because of false claims being made by the West, Russia resorts to proving up the facts. Again, evidence of what we should be doing when we have things coming down on us that are not correct. It's going to be very much more difficult as the government is recording our lives. We are going to have access to those as well. I don't know where this ends. And so I think that's an imposition that needs to be looked at and fought. This is an oppression that has no limit in the government. As an example, you now have to have a camera in your car in order to protect yourself from any number of different allegations that might come against you. But someone may have their video. You're going to have your own. There's nothing in your life that you may not be able to have to do this to everywhere. It really seems to be an oppressive burden in my mind. But the decrypted data, I thought this was a fascinating story. This came out pretty quickly after they did this. So let's think about this. Let's think about what we're talking about. Decrypted data. This used to be the secrets that war were won over, encryption, and are breaking it. Russia decrypted data from a UAV shot down in Novgorod region handed over to the U.S. side. Russian intelligence services were able to retrieve a flight mission file from one of the Ukrainian drones that attacked Putin's residence. Decrypted data from one of the Ukrainian drones that attacked Russian President Vladimir Putin's residence had been handed over to the U.S. mission in Moscow, the Russia Defense Ministry said on Thursday. On Monday, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that overnight from December 28th to 29th, Kiev had launched an attack on the Russian president's residence in Russia's Novgorod region using 91 drones. Quote, materials containing decrypted routing data and the flight controller of the Ukrainian drone that was shot down by Russian air defense systems on the night of December 29, 2025, over the Novgorod region during a terrorist attack on the Russian president's residence were handed over to a representative of the military attaché's office at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, the ministry said in a statement. The obtained data unequivocally confirmed that the drones were on their way to attack Putin's residence. The head of Russian General Staff's main intelligence directorate, Igor Kostyukov, who delivered the files to the U.S. Embassy, said, quote, we believe that this step will remove all questions and will contribute to establishing the truth, Kostyukov added. Now, what it doesn't remove is what a stupid, S-T-O-O-P-I-D, for the hearing sensitive, what a stupid stunt like this could mean. Drone attack on Putin's residence could have triggered a nuclear war. Here's why. Now, you know, I've been on this little bit, and some of this may be a little bit out there because there really are cooler heads prevailing. However, this is how close we are, how stupid this stuff is that's going on, and how Europe, I believe you, the UK, in helping Zelensky and their Nazis pull this off, how stupid they are, how close we are to nuclear war. The 91 drone attack on the presidential residence in Novgorod region was extremely dangerous provocation, and one that could, quote, not have been carried out without the participation of European hawks, close quote, because, quote, Zelensky would not have dared to plan or carry out such an operation on his own, military expert Alexei Leonkov told Sputnik. Intricate planning was required, and the timing, while Zelensky was in the U.S. for talks with Trump, was designed to give him an alibi, quote, which he is now using, claiming Ukraine had nothing to do with it, Leonkov said. That may go back to the prior story in the report. That's why Russia found it very important to go ahead and give the United States the evidence. I was interested to watch. They showed the video. They actually gave the hardware to the United States representative there. Fascinating. They also said they gave a written report about what they found. And so this decryption was very interesting as well. They gave the whole unit back. I assume, by looking at that, there was nothing that wasn't just off the shelf, and the encryption may not have been as military grade as people may have paid for. And if it was, we have evidence now Russia can decrypt all these encrypted channels. And that looked back at me when I looked at that and said, wow, that means that you have no encryption at all on your digital gulag there either. So fascinating position going on that Russia just exposed to everybody on this. The provocation, quote, wasn't simply an attack on the president, the Observer emphasized. Quote, it was a strike on a nuclear weapons control center, as each such residence contains communication nodes through which the head of state can issue the command to use the country's nuclear forces, close quote. It was intended to provoke a conflict between the U.S. and Russia, Leonkov said. Quote, this was precisely the calculation, at worst, provoking a global conflict, at minimum, disrupting the negotiation process between the U.S. and Russia. And it's clear that European hawks favor only this scenario, particularly Britain. Yes, particularly Britain. That we understand Trump loves Britain and the king and monarchs mostly. It's also reported Trump being very distant cousins, for those of you keeping track of that. While he issues denials now, as Trump is shocked and outraged, he claimed, that Kiev, not Pinocchio Linsky, could do such a thing. Zelensky essentially blabbed about the attack ahead of time, twice in the past 2 weeks, a press conference on December the 18th, when he said, quote, politicians change, somebody lives, somebody dies, close quote. And on Christmas Eve, when he openly called on Ukrainians to wish for Putin's death. Quote, all this suggests Zelensky was aware of the impending attack, but was playing his assigned role in this kabuki theater, pretending he had nothing to do with it and advocating for peace, Leonkov emphasized. Analyzing Moscow's public reaction carefully, Leonkov said two things are certain. First, Russia will respond appropriately, and the targets and time of the response have already been determined. Second, the response will be carried out in such a way as not to affect the negotiation process between Russia and the U.S. And just to bring us up to a little bit of date on that, the last information I have is they did strike. They did claim it was because of these attacks on the president and the nuclear system. And all they went after the drone manufacturing buildings and things like that. Not sure how effective that really is, but that's the message they sent back. They didn't raise it up. They're not wanting to raise it up to a nuclear capacity, but this is the problem. If anything had gotten through and they took out Putin or they took out a command center, Russia is already on record that said they will defend themselves and defend themselves by that. And giving the Nobel Peace Prize to warmongers is a crime that's gone on too long. Another observation on this Nobel political prize, actually, giving the Nobel Peace Prize to warmongers. You know, that shouldn't even be a possibility, but here we are. Here we have been. And if I look back on this, see, look at what Putin and Russia just did, they did pretty peaceful, just attacking the drone manufacturing plants. And I might wonder why they didn't attack those before. However, I'm not fighting that war or whatever they want to think it is. Established to reward the promotion of peace, the award has long been contaminated by politics and bias. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has accused the Nobel Foundation for breaking Swedish law when it bestowed its highest honor upon the pugilistic Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado. Before he died in 1896, the Swedish chemist Alfred Nobel made sure that his last will and testament was straightforward and unambiguous. The Nobel Peace Prize shall be awarded to the person who is the preceding year has, quote, done the most or the best work for fraternity between nations for the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and for the holding and promotion of peace congresses. And reading that and taking it on face value, have you ever known of anybody that has won the Peace Prize that has done that actually? I think shows how far away we are from that. But this is the standard. I thought that was fascinating to read. Judging by her past actions and comments and glowing praise for U.S. military aggression against her native country, Mikado, this year's recipient, fell far short of the mark, and that has Julian Assange up in arms. That's so peaceful too, right? But remember, Obama, the drone king, he got this. Did he did any of that thing? Did he do any of the fraternity between nations, the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and the holding and promotion of a peace congresses? Ever? Even one? I don't think so. In his criminal complaint filed this week in Sweden, Assange accused 30 individuals associated with the Nobel Foundation of committing serious crimes, including the crime of gross misappropriation of funds and facilitating of war crimes and crimes against humanity and the financing of the crime of aggression. The suspects, Assange asserts, converted, quote, an instrument of peace into an instrument of war, close quote, through a suspected, quote, serious criminality, close quote. For her part in all this, Mikado should be considered ineligible to receive her Peace Prize award of 11 million Swedish kronor, or $1.1 million. It seems that Assange has a point. After all, it is a secret to nobody that there has been a massive buildup of U.S. military forces off the coast of Venezuela beginning in August, which presently numbers around 15,000 personnel. Let me interject on that point, though. Is the U.S. military have anything to do with what Albert Nobel insisted had to happen for the prize? And so be careful as we read this that we don't include too much into all this to show how they are warmongers. But that's not the standard. The will of Albert Nobel was certain things. That was supposed to be met. And those forces have already committed war crimes, including the lethal targeting of civilian boats and survivors at sea, which has resulted in the death of at least 95 people, and now it's more. It's over 100. The Office of the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights labeled these U.S. coastal strikes against civilian boats, quote, extrajudicial executions, close quote, the WikiLeaks co-founder noted. Well, so did the guy behind the woodshed. How long ago? And the, quote, principal architecture of this aggression, close quote, was none other than U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who nominated Mikado for the Peace Prize. Ideologically incestuous, isn't it? Quote, Alfred Nobel's endowment for peace cannot be spent on the promotion of war, close quote, Assange stated emphatically. The accused have real legal obligations because they are tasked with, quote, ensuring the fulfillment of the intended purpose of Alfred Nobel's will, that is, to end war and war crimes and not enable them, close quote. Meanwhile, Mikado and the U.S. government have exploited the reputation of the Peace Prize to provide them with a casus moralis, a moral cause, for war against the South American nation and the ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the former bus driver and trade union leader turned national hero. Following a U.S.-led regime change, modus operandi that we've seen play out in other countries around the world, Mikado would be installed by force, and this would give the U.S. free rein over Venezuela's vast wealth in natural resources, including the largest oil reserves in the world. In an interview that aired on CBS News' Face the Nation, Mikado celebrated Trump's agenda of ratcheting up economic sanctions and seizing Venezuelan oil tankers, blatant acts of violence and aggression that appear to violate Nobel's clear declaration that the Peace Prize winner must promote fraternity between nations. Quote, look, I absolutely support President Trump's strategy, and we, the Venezuelan people, are very grateful to him and to his administration because I believe he is a champion of freedom in this hemisphere, the 58-year-old activist said. And that's why, and I say this from Oslo right now, to see she escaped Venezuela with help to go receive that prize, I have dedicated this award to him because I think that he finally has put Venezuela in where it should be in terms of priority for the United States national security. So Mercado knows how to drop names, doesn't she? National security. Makes me feel all warm and fuzzy with peacefulness. With such glowing words of praise for the U.S. superpower and its dubious objectives, it is more understandable why Assange warns that there remains the possibility that funds awarded to Mercado will be, quote, diverted from their charitable purpose to facilitate aggression, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, close quote. For such a thing to happen, the complaint alleges it would violate Sweden's obligations under Article 25.3c of the Rome Statute, which states that anyone who, quote, aids, abets, or otherwise assists, close quote, in the commissions of war crimes shall be subject to prosecution under the International Criminal Court. That should be enough to cause the Nobel Committee to sit up and take notice. The big question remains, to what degree does the Nobel Committee judge its recipients on how they comply with West's geopolitical agenda? Was NATO member Norway secretly compelled to elect a political agitator whose presence on the global stage would assist U.S. imperial ambitions in its backyard? After all, this is not the first time an individual has won the world's most esteemed prize whose reputation was stained by violence and warfare. Teddy Roosevelt, America's 26th president, won the prize in 1906 despite his determination to see the U.S. as a great power using military force, primarily in the Caribbean. In December 2009, then U.S. President Barack Obama won the Peace Prize while embroiled in two big wars. In 2016, his last full year as president, the U.S. dropped at least 26,171 bombs across seven countries. This equates to an average of 3 bombs every hour, 24 hours a day. Finally, U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1973, parenthetically shared with the North Vietnamese negotiator Lee Duc Ho, despite being harshly criticized for being the architect behind the secret bombing of Cambodia from March 1969 to May 1970. Two members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee resigned in protest, while the New York Times referred to it as the Nobel War Prize. Yep, that's won't get an objection out of the guy behind the woodshed on that. Nobel War Prize. Not like I've suggested similarly. This is BTWRLM 660. And to the indefinable gift that keeps on taking, Trump brands NYT a national security threat. U.S. media linked the criticism to a recent article examining the president's relationship with the late Jeffrey Epstein, who did not kill himself. U.S. President Donald Trump has branded the New York Times a national security threat in renewed criticism of the newspaper. Can I just remind us where this broadcast started in the First Amendment? In a Truth Social post on Tuesday, Trump accused the outlet of spreading, quote, lies and purposeful misrepresentations, close quote, and said it was a serious threat to national security of our nation. So the First Amendment is a serious threat to our nation. All right, got it. Now define our, and then define this nation without constitutional protections. Quote, their radical left unhinged behavior, writing fake articles and opinions, is a never-ending way, must be dealt with and stopped, Trump wrote, without specifying which materials had prompted his denunciation. But notice, more importantly, that what materials that Trump does not refer to anything that NYT did that is not protected by the First Amendment, such as defamation. Not one. Any material is at least irrelevant at this point. Also notice that he posted this in an unofficial forum. So I have a question. Has Trump defamed the publisher? Then tell me, what about the fake is not specifically authorized in law with the Smith Modernization Act, removing the prohibition that the government, such as Trump's administration, can propagandize to you, lie to you, misinform you, disinform you, and direct the media such as NYT to do so? And didn't they do so during the great Kobe swindle at warp speed? The president has a history of condemning news organizations he accuses of conspiring with political opponents to undermine his leadership. With Smith Munt in mind. Hypocrite much? U.S. media suggested the reaction was triggered by a recent New York Times article detailing what it described as a complicated friendship between Trump and the late financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who did not kill himself. The report said that the pair, quote, bonded over the pursuit of women, close quote. Materials from the Epstein estate are being released in a parallel by Congress and the Justice Department. Trump has repeatedly called the narrative that some files could damage him a Democrat hoax. So remember that. It's a hoax, he said. Trump said that the FBI could add all kinds of fake material. So think about that when you are ever charged with a crime that you were branded with. And I understand one victim came forward to identify a piece of evidence as fake. Others indicate abnormalities. Either may not be bad in the context of gathering everything for analysis, but not in the context of having passed through the analysis becoming evidence. His administration's handling of the records has been criticized over slow progress and extensive redactions, which are not actually redacted if you know the right highlight and copy the black barred text and paste it into another document. The bars are removed and that text shows right on through. Now, I'm not sure this is a new trick like some people suggest, having been done in another situation a number of years ago, though I can't remember exactly. And this would suggest it wasn't the government that didn't protect who they were to protect, but the reader did it. This is just like what Trump set up, so he can have deniability. It's fully in line with that Trump's plausible deniability to his donors, that he was against it, and that no account Representative Massey done it, and that the bill there was veto-proof. There's nothing that he could do, right? What is interesting is those I've read about that are going through the documents haven't found any victims' personal information that could be compromised, redacted, just legal entities and contracts for service, the business services that they're using in the investigations, which may have been possibly investigative methods and were excluded. At least some of Trump's claims about unfair media treatment appear valid. The BBC was recently found to have edited a speech he gave on January 6, 2020, in a way that created an impression that he had directed protesters to storm the Capitol. More recently, U.S. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard accused Reuters of trying to derail Trump's efforts to resolve the Ukrainian conflict after the British news agency reported U.S. intelligence assessment that allegedly claimed Russia intends to, quote, reclaim parts of Europe that belong to the former Soviet Empire, close quote. Moscow also dismissed the report as false. It's all false, but where are they judicially encumbered as being outside of the protection of the First Amendment? Or not under the very broad license given to governments to lie to you? Provided by that Smith Modernization Act, which that no account Massey was trying to get repealed, which was denied by Johnson to be even heard. So figure that one out. He's got a bill floating around to go ahead and repeal that Smith Modernization Act. And why haven't we heard about that and getting it repealed over Trump's continual objections and harangue on top of that, which again shows it, again, the hypocrite at least, but the play. We can get buy into it, or we can notice you know them when you see them. And they're not accomplishing a whole lot, and there's a reason for it. As SCOTUS rules against Trump, a National Guard justice says won't let him send troops to Chicago. The Supreme Court has put the brakes on one of President Trump's most aggressive law and order moves. So listen very carefully. He said it was for law and order. They didn't agree. There is a hierarchy that's still playing out in this country. And that's the kind of stuff I've been asking my listener to consider all the time and press forward as often as you need to. In an unsigned order Tuesday, the court blocked the president from sending National Guard troops into Chicago to protect immigration and customs enforcement personnel. Quote, at this preliminary stage, the government has failed to identify a source of authority that would allow the military to execute the laws in Illinois, the court said. There you have 2 points. Their authority. And it was the burden of the government again. So there's still this standard that is playing out. And not much different than things I've told you. The great COVID sort of comes to mind. The government had the burden to identify an infectious agent, failed its own laws. And that was the same answer as right there that Supreme Court gave to his power to enforce upon a state, the military, at issue was a federal law that lets presidents federalize the guard when they can't enforce federal law with regular forces. The justices signaled that that phrase most likely refers to the standing military, not all federal agents, and that the statute probably applies only in situations where the military is allowed to carry out law enforcement itself, not simply to back up immigration officers. And I found it peculiar they're talking about as if this is a question. Probably applies? Likely refers? That's our Supreme Court? Or this is a pretty big smackdown. But that's how they talk soft when they do that. That reading drew a rare split on the right side of the bench. Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch dissented. Alito, joined by Thomas, argued the court gave short shrift to what he called the president's inherent constitutional power to protect federal workers and property, and said there was, quote, no basis, close quote, to second-guess Trump's conclusion that civilian law enforcement wasn't enough to carry out immigration laws. The majority's view, he warned, could, quote, thwart, close quote, efforts to shield federal officers from potentially deadly attacks. Justice Brett Kavanaugh sided with the majority but urged a narrower approach. He agreed that regular forces means the U.S. military, yet cautioned that the court's broader legal reasoning could have, quote, potentially significant, close quote, ripple effects in future emergencies the justices can't yet anticipate. The Supreme Court took more than 2 months to rule on the administration's emergency request to overturn an October ruling that blocked the deployment of troops. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge April Perry said the deployment violated the 10th and the 14th Amendments, as well as the Posse Comitatus Act, which limits the use of military for law enforcement. She said the Department of Homeland Security depiction of events in Chicago was, quote, unreliable, close quote, adding, quote, I have seen no credible evidence that there is a danger of rebellion in the state of Illinois. So look at the standard there and the element of what was required. In another decision that goes against Trump, at least his words, certainly not his onshoring misdeeds, go ahead and tax those cruise ships. Federal judge upholds state's new levy set to go into effect January 1st for Mr. I'm going to cut out income taxes and now we're having a tax rebellion so-called. Folks, if you're within the sound of my voice, please stand down on the tax protest. Go read about taxes. Go read how you're liable. Go find out the people that have been put in jail. This is how I got started, is watching good people go to jail that I couldn't understand. Why are good people being abused? The government will abuse you. That's not a reason to not do a protest, but do it intelligently. There's a way to set yourself up to make you a lot less vulnerable. I would say use 2026 to do that and maybe try something in 2027 when you have a lot more underneath your belt. Don't just take your ex-Twitter's rampage or anywhere else. I guess that's my rant for that. I'm just seeing a bunch of stuff. People have gotten hurt bad and for no good reason. People die in jail because they thought they had it understood and they don't. When I say you live in an occupied territory, please take that as position number one on what you do now in an occupied territory with government that doesn't gets all the money. You don't have to pay them. They're going to get all the money they need to come and give you other civil rights. Your pains and your punishments come right after you don't want to pay your taxes. Find out how they're not your taxes and put yourself there before you even think about it, and then think about it some more. Don't become that precedent that makes it more even more difficult. They're looking for all that. But anyway, go ahead. Tax cruise ship. Extortion. Federal judge's ruling has cleared the way for Hawaii to include cruise ship passengers in a new tourist tax to help cope with climate change, a levy set to go into effect on the start of 2026. U.S. District Judge Jill A. Otake denied a request this week that sought to stop officials from enforcing the new law on the cruises. In the nation's first such levy to help cope with a warming planet, Hawaii Governor Josh Green signed legislation in May that raises tax revenue to deal with eroding shorelines, wildfires, and other climate problems. Officials estimate the tax will generate nearly $100 million annually. But I'd ask anyone to first look at the Hawaii Supreme Court rules to see if the ABA, the American Bar Association, is involved at all or named in the rules, as it is in Tennessee for one, if not all the states actually, but see that nice and clearly in Tennessee. And to remember that the ABA, in its official House resolutions going back to at least 1991, I think it was, which I've read behind the woodshed, it intends on promoting sustainable development. In fact, the entire state government promotes foreign sustainability there. So the judge, derelict to find the fraud in that claim, will never be found out there in Hawaii on this. And no, if it is the fact that the ABA controls the judiciary, the Hawaiian judicial branch is inherently biased and has been administratively captured by a foreign, later domesticated corporation, and by its members, likely the legislature and the local governments as well. So the judicial branch is not judicially independent of a foreign undue influence, political in nature, as I've explained before. And we know that because global warming, an instrumental tool of the global change agents, climate change is not about the weather. And notice, the judge agreed to the fraud called climate change, and that it's okay to perpetually wrongfully extort fiat from people or companies to deal with the fraudulent fabricated effects. The judge didn't order, because the evidence proved climate change was an actual cause, because there is no evidence or a reason not tainted by fraud, that the judge didn't order that the funds be applied only to known harmless methods that stop the cause, because cruise ships are not the cause of Earth's weather. But no, the ABA member judge allowed a perpetual debt extorted from its victims of the fraud to accomplish nothing forever. And is not justice, but it is the forever future servitude that they want for you. And it would be great to see every one of those cruise ships find another Pacific paradise to visit, I think. And let Hawaii stew in its tropical heat with its belching volcanoes. If Hawaii was serious about what it claims it believes about climate change, no ship or airplane would stop at Hawaii, tuki-tuki. And then we'll see how long the state can survive on taxing breadfruit, guava, and pineapples, demanding payment in puka shells. Because who will pay for the carbon-based roads? Right, Jeff? Oh, and you've heard me say repeatedly in the past, wildfire is largely a fire fuels management problem. Not fire management, proper forest management. Is a self-inflicted wound the Hawaii can't seem to handle in its own backyard, but intends to help the global atmosphere. And eroding beaches are not submerging beaches due to sea level rise, because that's not happening either. But beaches are known to seasonally destroy and rebuild themselves. Well, unless man has modified the coast or the current somehow upstream. And, quote, other climate effects that we read is the catch-all term for, if we say it enough, you'll believe it. And, oh, don't mind you that lava pouring into the sea, burying the beach, or those carbon-based roads, or all that steam and noxious gases, because the pesky problem is all those anthropogenics and the cruise ships they rode in on, don't you know? So when I say there's no evidence the judge could use, there is literally no valid evidence, and the truth eventually rises to the top. Authors retract Nature paper projecting high costs of climate change. The authors of a highly publicized study predicting climate change could cost $38 trillion, tango dollars, a year by 2049 have retracted their paper following criticism of the data and methodology, including that the estimate is inflated. But trust the science, folks. Quote, the economic commitment of climate change, which appeared in April 17, 2024 in Nature, looked at how changes in temperature and precipitation could affect economic growth Forbes, the San Diego Union Tribune, and other outlets covered the paper, which had been accessed over 300,000 times and had been cited in 168 times. But after two commentaries published this August raised questions about the study's data and methodology, the researchers revisited their findings. Let me interject there. Somebody caused the question. They took the time, penciled the paper, penned the paper, digits to computers, and they sent something in. They just didn't acknowledge, oh, there's a problem, and walk away. And in this case, I guess they had to have the cred to do it. But see, the truth would overcome any lack of so-called official cred, wouldn't it? And it might take a little bit longer for you. What I'm saying is, when you see this problem, write somebody. Don't just let it go by. Challenge authority. Because as you see, it ends up costing people their money. It's crime, official crime by the government. Because as Jeff Maddox will tell us in his brilliant little statement to the local county government, who will pay for the roads, right? Well, miners used to do the roads. They used to make them to go get their mineral. So you don't ask a miner about that. We already know who makes the roads. And we did quite fine for a long time. Quote, the authors acknowledge that these changes are too substantial for a correction, the retraction notice published today states. In July 2024, Nature issued a correction to the article that it addressed rows of data which were wrongly printed as a decimal rather than a percentage point. And remember, we went through this a couple episodes ago relative to your vitamins and how they established those, and they were the wrong analysis. They did the wrong averaging in order to come up with their answer. But trust the science. Nature has retracted 32 papers since 2020, including three in 2024. The retraction today marks the sixth for the journal in 2025. So again, trust the science, but this isn't science. This is statistics. And we've seen in the last episode that it matters what is figured and how. So I suppose until these people do science, then maybe we'll look at it. Until then, lies, damn lies and statistics, or is that figures won't lie, but liars will figure? And to the link I send you in the Blogcaster retraction note, the economic commitment of climate change, the title, authors have retracted this paper for the following reasons. Post-publication, the results were found to be sensitive to the removal of one country, Uzbekistan, where inaccuracies were noted in the underlying economic data for the period of 1995 to 1999. Furthermore, spatial autocorrelation was argued to be relevant for the uncertainty ranges. The authors corrected the data from Uzbekistan from 1995 to 1999 and controlled for data source transitions and higher order trends as a result of the Uzbekistan data. They also accounted for spatial autocorrection. These changes led to discrepancies in the estimates for climate damages by mid-century, with an increased uncertainty range from 11 to 29% to 6 to 31%, and lower probability of damages diverging across emission scenarios by 2050, parenthetically, from 99% to 90%. But emission scenarios, emission narratives, like they just made them up. The authors acknowledge that these changes are too substantial for correction, leading to the retraction of the paper. Now on to the CYA rewrite that they're planning to do on this. You'll see that in there also. But I was wondering, did they get that information in the car travels and whatever from Uzbekistan from the flock cameras? Why was that a central core, and why to the future they want in agents, change agents that were using their data? Just a question. Just fascinating to me. But they pushed this hard. You see what they said at the time of the promotion. No one investigating the veracity of the claimed narratives. New study calculates climate change's economic bite will hit about $38 trillion a year by 2049, the original article that came out to all of us in the news. It calculates, they say, again, figures won't lie, but liars will figure. The climate change will reduce, understand, it's not about the figures. Climate change is not about the weather. So let's get that straight up. And now what are you going to talk about? Climate change will reduce a future global income by about 19%, they said, in the next 25 years compared to the fictional world that's not warming. The fictional world that's not warming. And they wrote a fictional paper about a warming world. That's science, I suppose. With the poorest areas of these least responsible for heating the atmosphere taking the biggest monetary hit, a new study said. Climate change does not recognize any inputs from the sun. So what heating and how was it differentiated then to establish the problem? Climate change's economic bite is how much people make is already locked in at $38 trillion a year by 2049, according to the Wednesday study in the journal Nature for researchers at Germany's Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. By 2100, the financial costs could hit twice what previous studies estimate. Be afeared, folks. Actually, climate change will bite only so hard as you allow yourself to put your head in their bear trap. Quote, our analysis, which we know was wrong now, shows that the climate change will cause massive economic damages within the next 25 years in the almost all countries around the world, also in highly developed ones such as Germany, the U.S., with a project medium income reduction of 11% each, and France with 13%, said the study, a co-author, Leonie Wentz, a climate scientist and economist. It seems like Germany's stubborn protection of Ukraine's Nazis have taken the only bite I can see in this time. These damages are compared to a baseline of no climate change and are then applied against overall expected global growth in gross domestic product. We just make this stuff up, folks, said the study lead author, Max Coates, a climate scientist. What was the control group for the no climate change world in this study? Anyway, so much for trusting the science. And it was a lie, and it wasn't science either, was it? Now they'll rewrite the study so-called, because if you'll notice, as long as it is in the news, climate change has validity. The fraud never goes away, because climate change is not about the weather. And that's what everybody seems to miss while they have you focused on all the numbers that they're lying about. So again, cautious of the fact they're coming back with a rewrite on what? The underlying fraud. They're just going to give you more time to absorb and buy into what they're saying. Now, speaking of ignoring molten lava and noxious fumes in Hawaii, how cool is this? And I wonder if these people in Africa will finally be able to bake their bread, cookies, and pizza, because I'm sure the birds will adapt. Remember that story in that episode? Behind the woodshed, Ethiopian volcano erupts for first time in 10,000 years. Plumes of ash were sent 45,000 feet in the sky with winds carrying volcanic material toward the Arabian Sea. No, it's climate change, folks. The long-dormant Haile Gebirge volcano in northeastern Ethiopia has erupted for the first time in more than 10 millennia. And it's not the only one, and this is what starts getting really fascinating for me and something I wish I was more studying in and could go back to and do some more study about, just the general dynamics of the Earth and how this all thing is put together, try to figure out, if we could, what's going on. That's much more fascinating than a bunch of scientists that cook the books, isn't it? According to the Toulouse Volcanic Ash Advisory Center, the eruption began around 8:30 a.m. UTC on Sunday, with explosive activity continuing for several hours. Ash clouds were sent to around 45,000 feet in the sky. The local administrator, Mohammed Seed, said that there has been no human or livestock casualties, but many villages are blanketed in ash, leaving grazing animals with little to eat. And so this is another I want to point out. Listen what nature does and look what happens around one of these volcanoes. And if you're in the vicinity of one, even one they said is asleep and won't come back because it's dormant, be prepared for this kind of thing. This is what's kind of interesting about all these long-term silences or not. The Earth is a living thing, it seems. And she'll tell us when she wants to wake up here and shake over there. Afar TV quoted Professor Adelaide Ayale of Addis Ababa University Institute of Geophysics, Space Science, and Astronomy. Let's get the astronomy. Maybe the solar astronomy. Let's go out in the solar system. Maybe there's something there that's all interested about this grouping and this professor, who attributed the event to a movement of interaction of molten rock beneath the area. Holly Gooby had not had any known eruption since the Holocene epoch began around 12,000 years ago. Another interesting date, in generality anyway, according to the Smithsonian Institute's Global Volcanism Program. The eruption produced a large plume of ash moving toward Yemen and Oman, according to experts cited by several media outlets. Earlier this year, Ethiopia witnessed renewed activity of other volcanoes. Thousands of residents were evacuated in January after intense steam emissions near the long-dormant volcano of Dauphin Mountain in Afar region raised fears of possible eruption. Just weeks earlier, in late December 2024, heightened seismic activity was detected around the Fentale volcano in Oromia region. But maybe dormant isn't the right characterization for these mountain creatures that time forgot. What do you think? It is all over the world's going on. It's really fascinating. I'm still looking at whether or not the Earth has relaxed a bit, but the last big earthquake in northern Japan, I did not see that reflection where it was looking like it might be. So there's still another thing going on since the Banda Aceh quake. Long-term stuff here. And that's not too long ago either. But anyway, interesting. 12,000 years ago, what a cool thing. And what other ones are sitting down there grumbling around that might come up? And we don't have to wait for a sleepy volcano to hit the snooze alarm reset as scientists pinpoint why time runs faster on Mars. A new study tied orbital swings and tiny daily time gains. Time isn't just weird on Mars. It's literally quicker. As Vice reports, scientists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology have now calculated exactly how faster time flows in the red planet, and the difference is no small rounding error. Again, calculated. Where's the science? It's math, but where's the science? An atomic clock on Mars would gain 477 microseconds per day compared to one on Earth, and that leads shifts up to 226 microseconds depending on where Mars is in the orbit. That means Martian time isn't just offset, it's variable, which is a key concern for any future navigation, communication, and timing system that needs microsecond level accuracy. Quote, that's not huge, but that's a big in context of precision measurements, the NIST physicist Bijunath Patla said. We already knew Mars keeps its own schedule. Days to run around 40 minutes longer than Earth's, and its year spans 687 days, but the new finding confirms something physicists have long predicted. NASA, NASA, notes that general relativity, the same physics that makes Interstellar so mind-bending, explains that clocks run faster where gravity is weaker. And because Mars has less mass and lower surface gravity, clocks there should tick slightly quicker than those on Earth. Kind of about speaking with helium, I suppose, huh? But the NIST team at work went a step further by quantifying how much quicker and revealing that the rate itself changes day by day. Patlaw and his colleagues traced this shifting drift to gravitational interplay among Mars, Earth, and the Sun, and even the Moon, which subtly alters Mars' motion and gravitational field over time. We've been studying this classic three-body problem, Patlaw said, but now it's become a four-body problem. Studying the time difference is about far more than just curiosity. Any future astronaut, spacecraft, or Elon Musk, you listening to this? I hope you're figuring this out. You don't want to miss Mars, right? You're going to die there, you say. You spend all this money and time and pollute our environment, but you're going to get there to die. Great. Any future astronauts, spacecraft, and autonomous rovers operating on Mars will need clocks that stay synchronized with Earth despite the constantly shifting gravitational influence. Even tiny mismatches accumulate, throwing off positioning systems, communication schedules, and scientific measurements. The team's work provides the first precise map of how Martian time actually behaves across an orbit, which is a foundational step toward interplanetary navigation. And while the daily difference is microscopic, the principle is profound. Time isn't the same across the solar system. And it's all connected, isn't it? Isn't that fascinating? But there is no sun, right, Greta? But something artificial intelligence couldn't pinpoint with any accuracy, and yet another proof AI is not intelligence, artificial or organic, why AI couldn't crack an 11th century Italian mystery. Historians' experiment shows chatbots can't match human historical insight. Art historian in Florence decided to see if AI could crack the mystery he'd just spent years solving, and it couldn't. Elon Danziger's finding was this, that Florence's Battistery of San Giovanni was not a homegrown project, but a papal-led initiative under Pope Gregory VII in the late 11th century. He put three chatbots, ChatGPT, Claude, and Gemini, to the test, seeing if they could sift through scholarship, notice the same historic oddities he did, and arrive at his conclusion about who built the landmark and why. As Danziger writes in the New York Times, which is a national security threat, they managed the data mining part but stalled at the leap of interpretation, never assembling a fresh explanation from scattered clues. The interpretation. AI cannot actually interpret from patterns. These models merely recite patterns found and explained in a sort of conversational way. Danziger says the problem lies in how large language models work. They excel at finding and summarizing patterns in mainstream thinking, but their very strength makes them prone to ignoring, quote, eccentric and contrarian ideas, close quote, that can trigger breakthroughs. A 2006 book by scholar Guido Hügler, which proposed a later date for the baptistery, was central to Danziger's own shift in perspective. AI never surfaced it when asked what text it planned to rely on, perhaps because Tigler's idea is, quote, not widely accepted, close quote. And boy, wouldn't that be something when your AI, government AI infrastructure wants to seek out and not appreciate your contrarian views. When prodded to examine a long-assumed 1059 consecration of the Battistra by Pope Nicholas II, an event for which no direct records exist, two bots noted the gap but did treat it as noteworthy, while Gemini invented supporting evidence. For Danziger, the exercise doubles as a caution about what AI can and cannot do for scholarship. As for, what about your life, folks? What about the government using it to intrude your life? As for his own scholarship, Danziger zeroed in on the following. An 11th century Florence, arguably too poor to fund such a sophisticated building, the Battistery's heavy architecture debt to Rome's Pantheon, by then a papal church, and a local crisis of confidence in a corrupt bishop that pushed Florentines away from baptisms in their own city. Remove Nicholas II and focus on popes fixated on Rome's ancient heritage, and Gregory VII, who became pope in 1073, becomes, in his view, the only plausible driving force behind the project. And so put, again, this little evidence, someone testing AIs, I've asked you to do for yourself. It cannot think. It cannot interpret. It just responds, and then it can hallucinate on that, trying to please its so-called master. And something else that the Pope recently visited in a far-off land, mainly focusing on apologizing for the Catholic Church's role in the Canadian Indian residential school system and on reconciliation with the country's indigenous peoples, maybe a foreshadowing of claiming sovereignty without possessing it. Listen very carefully on what the history of this last year has done relative to the king moving over and doing what he did. The Canadian government is brain damaged, exposing the contradictions at the heart of the liberal legal order. In August 2025, the British Columbia Supreme Court declared that the Cowichan tribe's land rights do not derive from Canadian state but precede it, and that Crown actions inconsistent with those rights were beyond the Crown's lawful power. The decision does not instantly dispossess private owners, but it does something deeper. It reveals that Canada cannot determine the scope of its own authority without appealing to an older external sovereignty. Modern liberal states claim unitary, indivisible sovereignty, that the state is the final authority over territory. But here, the Canadian state acknowledges that another authority, older than the state itself, possesses rights that the Crown cannot revoke. This means that the Crown is not the final arbiter of land ownership. A pre-Crown polity is. The problem is crystallized when reviewed through an absolutist lens. Sovereignty is absolute, perpetual, and unlimited, or it's not sovereignty at all. John Bodine defines sovereignty as, quote, the highest power over citizens and subjects unbound by laws, closed quote. And I want people in the United States to recognize when you are given exclusive possession and enjoyment, even against the government, what this starts to mean here. But for this one, the indigenous people have a right that predates pre-crown polity, will rule for them, essentially. This is like the Oklahoma case done in the United States. Thus, if another authority can bind or constrain the prince, that other authority is the real sovereign. For it is well-established rule that not only privileges, but not even laws or edicts retain their force after the death of a prince, unless they are confirmed by the authority or even the tacit consent of subsequent princes. As Pomponius said, quote, no obligation can be valid which depends entirely upon the will of the one making the promise, close quote. This is not merely a probable reason, but one that is logically necessary for conviction, namely, that a prince cannot in any way be bound by his own laws and commands. Just as interpreters of canon law say that a supreme pontiff cannot bind his own hands, so too the supreme prince, indeed not even a magistrate or private citizen, can issue an edict or command to himself. Hence, that common formula at the end of all laws and edicts, as in Rome, we have willed and decreed it, to be understood as meaning that the laws, however just, depend solely on the will of the one who commands them. A sovereign cannot share a delegate sovereignty without ceasing to be a sovereign. If Canada cannot revoke or delimit Aboriginal title because it's not Canada's to alter, then Canada is not a sovereign entity. Sovereignty is a simple test. Who commands and who must obey? By accepting that Indigenous title limits to the Crown and that these limits arise from the polity older than Canada itself, the Liberal state effectively concedes that its sovereignty neither absolute nor final. Liberal states try to hold together two incompatible claims, that the Crown is supreme and that the Crown is bound by an authority it cannot alter. The absolutist tradition simply reveals this inconsistency with brutal clarity. The facts, what the court actually decided. Under Canadian jurisprudence, Aboriginal title is an inherent right. It does not flow from the Crown, nor is it delegated right, nor a gift of legislation. The court in Cowichan simply applies this doctrine. Cowichan title originates from pre-contact political societies, not from Canadian law. This is crucial. Aboriginal title is recognized, not created by the Crown. Its source lies outside the Canadian constitutional order. The Crown historically treated the land as if the Crown itself possessed full sovereignty over it, but the court has now found no evidence that Aboriginal title was ever lawfully extinguished. To extinguish Aboriginal title, the Crown must act with a clear and plain intention, and historically it did not. Therefore, the original Cowichan title survives into the present. The implication is dire. The Crown acted ultra vires, beyond its legal authority, for over a century. Its supposed authority rested on a legal fiction that it has now formally repudiated. This aspect of the ruling caused public alarm, but its meaning is strictly legal. If the Crown has no right to the granted land, then the resulting private titles rest on a shaky foundation. The court did not order the expropriation of existing holders' property, but it did acknowledge the foundational defect. So rather than deciding the matter, the court instructed the Crown to bargain. The Cowichan ruling compels the state to treat another authority as capable of vetoing or redefining Crown decisions. Both federal and provincial governments are legally powerless to repeal Aboriginal title. Even Parliament cannot annul it. Section 35 of the Constitution places Indigenous rights beyond ordinary legislation. As a result, Aboriginal title occupies a higher legal plane than most Crown actions. And if I can interject on that, if it was in your constitution, that was just reflecting this decision, wasn't it, ahead of time? And people were ignoring that point. it's so important about understanding property as I do for the United States, as I do for the United States where they've given over exclusive possession and enjoyment. Everyone wants to know why there's property tax. Well, go look and see if there's been a corruption. Maybe you can get it back, go to your enabling acts, see where the obligation of the state was to protect the grants of Congress and its own land grants in this very way. As a result, Aboriginal title occupies a higher legal plane than most Crown actions. In some ways, this mirrors the Roman law of tribunal sacrosanctitis, which effectively made tribunes competing sovereigns within the Roman state. This had predictable revolutionary consequences that led to the end of the Republic. The court softened the blow by delaying the consequences of property holders for 18 months, but delays don't change the substance of what's happened. The Crown exceeded its powers. The state acted as if it held absolute authority and now admits it does not. The Cowichan ruling does not need embellishment to be radical. It states plainly the Indigenous authority over parts of Canada predates the state, outlived every Crown action meant to replace it, and stands beyond the reach of Parliament. The logic of this decision is catastrophic. Canada does not possess sovereignty over its territory, and applied consistently, one can see no reason why it would possess it over any territory. Father Cowichan's decision is philosophically explosive. We have already discussed Bowden at length. Sovereignty is the undivided, unbounded power to command, and saw a sovereign who must bow to an older independent authority, as Canada must bow to Aboriginal title, is not sovereign. The Cowichan decision reveals that Canadian sovereignty is split, and a split sovereignty is no sovereignty at all. Bowden's absolutist definition of sovereignty as, quote, unbounded by the laws, close quote, rests not upon mere assertion, but upon reason. Rule of law is not and cannot, even in principle, be valid. Think about these powerful things about land and possession. To place law above the agent who exercises it as a contradiction, it is in the very nature of the relationship between the sovereign and law that the sovereign be above the law. Robert Filmer illustrates this with a vivid analogy. It is not the law that is the minister of God or that carries the sword, but the ruler or magistrate. So they that say the law governs the kingdom may all as well say that the carpenter's rule builds the house and not the carpenter, for the law is but the rule or instrument of the ruler. This is to say that sovereignty is something essentially personalistic. Filmer insists that power must be vested in a person, a locus of ultimate authority. But Canada's authority is conditioned by Indigenous rights standing above it. If the Crown cannot command without permission from a pre-existing authority, the Crown is not a sovereign person. Authority lies with the priority polity whose will constrains the state. Joseph de Maistre illustrates the further points about sovereign authority, which is latent in Bodine's, quote, unbound by the laws, close quote, condition, which is that the sovereign reserves to itself the right of final decision. Infallibility in the spiritual orders of things and the sovereignty in the temporal order are two words perfectly synonymous. The one and the other denote that high power which rules over all the powers, from which they all derive their authority, which governs and is not governed, which judges and is not judged. This is so by necessity, since an anarchic vacuum where authority is never final in a venue for endless contest, or as he says, quote, wherever there is no sentence, there is combat, close quote. Sovereignty is the power that renders the final decision, the one authority that judges and is not judged. But Canada's decisions about land, jurisdiction, and title are not final. They are judged against Indigenous authority. This means that sovereignty, the power to decide, I'll repeat that. This means that sovereignty, the power to decide, does not lie in the Canadian state. The decisionist principle extends into modern era as well. Under Schmitt's famous definitions, quote, sovereign is he who decides on the exception, close quote. The sovereign is the power that decides when the normal legal order can be suspended. Trump, is that you? The ability to suspend rules is a hallmark of sovereignty, an iteration of Bowden's unbound condition. But Canada fails this test because it cannot suspend Aboriginal title. It can neither extinguish it, limit it unilaterally, override it in emergencies, nor declare an exception to it. If the Crown cannot suspend or supersede indigenous rights even in a crisis, it does not possess the exception deciding power. A very interesting condition up there in Canada, and I thought that was great to look through the property aspects of all that. If we were to go back in the United States and look at the basic law behind the patents, and the Congress grants and extinguishes its power in its grant to the people of the United States evidenced in the patent, you're talking about this condition in the United States for everybody that complains about their property tax. As I tell you, there's been a corruption, a fraudulent characterization of these lands that should not suffer a second opinion, that have been, because they've been mischaracterized to be in the marketplace and not a grant of a sovereign to you, which is the express statement that this case in Canada said the Crown did not do historically. So a very powerful story here. I don't know, I haven't looked at it anymore to find out where this is going and how they're going to treat it. To me, it was more like the Oklahoma story where the indigenous people or the aboriginals would be deciding their own, and this was reduced to a criminal condition, and everybody who lived there weren't really going to be displaced in their property rights. But nevertheless, there's laws and things and old orders that are ignored, intentionally ignored. The king came over to specifically reconcile it, his position with the indigenous people earlier this year, and I wondered why. I asked behind the woodshed, but here we are. Here's what that case was about, and this is where it went to. This has been the BTW RLM 660, and I'll be with you next week. Tech Diffs, for nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, piercing free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. An unquenchable thirst behind the woodshed. No stone unturned. House words ignite. The airwaves burn. Stand up, listen. It's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. So mark the time when Sunday comes. Behind the woodshed, beating drums. House voice, a beacon, fierce and bold. Then fight the truth. Next week, heed the call, behind the woodshed standing tall.